This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Boker Tov, everybody. So, Bob mentioned something about old issues, new faces, and the ability to look at an old text. And actually, he felt that Gila Fein had done it in a different way, and again, it fits in with that idea of old issues, new faces. So we're actually going to look at some old issues and some old faces. And then we'll try to also see how some of this relates to some of our contemporary issues in Israel today. So the real title of this session is, and I think it might have been listed somewhere that way. I wish it would have been titled that way even on the schedule. The real title of this session is, What's the Problem? What's the Solution? That's really the title of this session. What's the problem? What's the solution? And actually, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, people kept referring to what they called the Jewish question or the Jewish problem. Now, it's true that for some of us, that language is already painful just to hear. Of course, a little bit later in the 20th century, the Nazis used the term the final solution to the Jewish question. But that just tells us that that's the terminology even Jews were using in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So what is the Jewish question at the turn of that century? What is the Jewish problem that Jews and non-Jews are talking about in Europe? Yes? Well,
basically, the persistence of anti-Semitism despite the Enlightenment and the Emancipation, and is the solution essentially a return to Zion?
Well, wait, the solution that some Jews will have will be return to Zion, but the question is not really just anti-Semitism, because otherwise they would have called it the anti-Semitism question. Why do they call it the Jewish question? Anti-Semitism has something to do with it, yes?
I think it's more the integration of Jews into the larger society.
The question is, how do the Jews fit in, if at all, into their respective European societies? How do they fit in? Do they fit in? Because of the persistence of anti-Semitism? Because of the persistence of the Jews somehow wanting to remain Jewish for the most part? And somehow wanting to be in the same neighborhoods? And somehow socially, either by their own choice or because of anti-Semitism, quote unquote, banding together? Somehow the Jews don't fit in so easily into late 19th century and early 20th century Europe. And then here, I go back a little bit, and this will be chazara, this will be review for the people who were in my class about the origins of modern Zionism a couple of days ago. This goes back to the question of the emancipation. Beginning with the French Revolution, the Jews of Europe are granted equality. They're granted civil rights or emancipation. First in France and later across all of Europe over the course of the 1800s, over the course of the 19th century. And in every one of those countries, there was a debate. Should we grant the Jews equality or not? And the people who were in my class a few days ago, we were able to read some of the primary sources about the debate in France. The first debate. And let's just, for those people who are in the class, I'm testing you now. What were the reasons to grant the Jews equality? I see that big show of hands. Why grant the Jews equality, Alan?
Because it was being granted to everyone.
Right, because we believe in equality, because the slogan of our revolution is liberté, égalité, fraternité. So if we believe in equality, so we have to grant the Jews equality. Okay? That's a powerful argument. That's the mantra of our revolution. That's the mantra of the 19th century as time goes on across much of Europe. If we're granting everybody equality, if we're granting everyone the right to vote, not just property holders, for example, then we have to grant the Jews the right to vote too, and other rights as well. So equality before the law, as it appears in the French Revolution, in the Napoleonic Code, all of that is a very powerful engine driving emancipation. On the other hand, why should we not grant the Jews emancipation? Why should we not grant them equality? What's wrong with giving the Jews equality in our country? Yes?
Because they're not really French, necessarily.
Yeah, are they really Frenchmen? Are they really Frenchmen? I mean, what were some of the examples that were given in the documents we were reading? Why weren't the Jews really Frenchmen?
The number of days they didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a different calendar than we do. Right? And they have so many valueless days in the year, said the Bishop of Nancy. Right? What else?
Jealousy. They have a tendency to take over banking and business. Get too big for their boots.
They seem to take over everything. They seem to take it. The Bishop of Nancy writes that his parishioners came to him and said, yes, if you were to pass away, the Jews would probably replace you with one of their own. They're so clever at taking over everything. Right? They cornered the wheat market. They cornered this. They're very clever. They're not like us. They're somehow different. What else? How else are the Jews different in France or in Germany or in England in the 1800s?
They cited our liturgy. And the fact that, as a group, we still somehow longed for returning to Israel.
The Jews aspire to another homeland. Look at their liturgy. They're praying to return to Zion. And when they pray, they don't face Paris. They face Jerusalem. That's their homeland. They're not really loyal Frenchmen. They're just here temporarily. If they had their way, they wouldn't be here. Are they really loyal Frenchmen? And on top of all of that, a lot of them don't even speak French. And if they do speak French, they don't speak French properly. And by the way, of all of the peoples of Europe, I think the ones that are most careful about how their language is spoken are the French. When you speak French with an accent, they don't like it so much. Okay? They're a little less tolerant, I think, than many other people. And the Jews, most of them lived in Alsace-Lorraine. They lived under German rule. They were Yiddish speaking. They spoke with a German accent. And on top of everything else, not only is it a foreign accent, but the Germans are the arch rivals of the French, the enemies of the French. So are they really Frenchmen? Do they dress like Frenchmen? This has contemporary reverberations, by the way, not only for Jews, particularly in France. But all of this is happening across all of Europe. We use France as a case study, but actually it's happening in Germany, it's happening in England, it's happening in Sweden, it's happening in Russia, and in Hungary, in Austria-Hungary. Do the Jews really belong or not? By the late 19th century, most of the Jews have actually been granted emancipation across Europe. I think only Tsarist Russia and Spain had not yet granted the Jews emancipation. And this emancipation was fragile. That is, even after the Jews are granted emancipation, people question it. One example of that is Napoleon. In 1806, about a decade after, 15 years after the Jews were granted emancipation in France, Napoleon calls together what he calls the Assembly of Jewish Notables. He calls together a group of prominent Jews, and he poses these questions to them. Is it lawful for Jews to marry more than one wife? Is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Can a Jewess marry a Christian, or a Jew a Christian woman? And then, in the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen considered as brethren or as strangers? And he goes on, what conduct does the Jewish law prescribe toward Frenchmen not of their religion? Do the Jews born in France and treated by the law as French citizens consider France as their country? And there are a few other questions, but and the last two are, does the law forbid the Jews from taking usury from their brethren? Does it forbid or does it allow usury toward strangers? You can see these are very pointed questions. And these are questions that the Assembly of Jewish Notables is going to have to respond to. They're the questions of a dictator. Napoleon was a dictator. The Jews desperately wanted to keep their emancipation, and they try their best to answer it in a way that will satisfy Napoleon. But it's a sign, 15 years after the emancipation, that the emancipation can be questioned. And in fact, the Napoleonic armies bring the Napoleonic Code to Europe as they conquer most of Europe. And everywhere, the ghetto walls come down, figuratively or literally. The ghetto walls come down because now Jews are granted equality. But Napoleon is defeated. And when he's defeated, there is an age of reaction. Nobility once again becomes nobility. Monarchy is reinstated in many countries, even in France for a period. And the Jews have the old restrictions placed on them once again. There's a classic example of this in Germany. The famous German writer Heinrich Heine was born Jewish. And the Napoleonic armies come, and they liberate, quote-unquote, the Jews of Germany. And Heinrich Heine decides to go to law school, something he could never do as a Jew before the emancipation under Napoleon. He goes to law school. He graduates law school. Napoleon is defeated. The age of reaction sets in. The clock is turned back. He's not allowed to sit for the bar exam. What does Heinrich Heine do?
He converts.
He converts to Christianity. And he writes. It's not that he's a believer, but he just doesn't want those restrictions. And by the way, it's not talked about very much, but over the course of the 1800s, thousands, probably tens of thousands of German Jews converted to Christianity.
Right? If I may, a quote that I read in a wonderful book called The Pity of It All.
Oh, The Pity of It All, by Amos Elon.
About Heinrich Heine. He said he was no more a Christian after his conversion than he was a Jew before.
Yes. Yes, if that's all it takes for someone to convert, it shows it's not very, very important to him. There were thousands, probably tens of thousands, of German Jews who converted in the 1800s in order to gain acceptance of one kind or another, in order to take the bar exam, and even after emancipation, in order to gain social acceptance. And we know two examples of that in America that came out in the last couple of decades. Remember Madeleine Albright? Right? All of a sudden it came out that her great-great-grandfather or somebody was Jewish, and she claimed she didn't even know about it. And the same was true of John Kerry. John Kerry had a great-grandfather. I think he or Madeleine was from Czechoslovakia. It doesn't matter.
Yes,
it's a German
name.
She was from Czechoslovakia. He had a great-grandfather or great-grandmother who was, or both, who were Jewish. And they converted, and he found out about it only, I think, when he was running for president, which, of course, is ancient history, but nonetheless, those are just two small examples. Who knows how many other people are running around not knowing that actually they have German Jewish ancestry, But they converted, and they converted for social acceptance, because even after the emancipation of the Jews in Germany in 1870, there remains a social barrier. Legally, the Jews are equal, but still they don't fit in socially. And I want to read to you a quote from Jacob Katz. Jacob Katz, one of the great Jewish historians of the 20th century, Hebrew University. In his book about anti-Semitism called From Prejudice to Destruction, Jacob Katz writes about this time period. The struggle did not end with the achievement of formal equality or emancipation. The hope, or perhaps more accurately, the social utopia, this is for you, Alan, that was intertwined with the attainment of civil rights for Jews, that the Jews would no longer be differentiated from other citizens except by their faith. That was not fulfilled. The Jews remained a distinct social group by virtue of their marriages, their concentration in certain professions, their social cohesiveness, their maintenance of particular cultural patterns, and their denial of the predominant religion, even after their naturalization. So this is the Jewish problem. This is the Jewish question that both Jews and non-Jews are talking about in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century. And there are various Jewish responses to that Jewish question. One of them was the development of denominations within Judaism, the modern denominations within Judaism. Development of reform, positive historical Judaism, which we call today conservative Judaism, and neo-orthodoxy, which we call today modern orthodoxy. Those three all develop in Germany in the 19th century, in the early and mid-19th century, and they are clearly a response to the emancipation and modernization. Jews wanted to prove their loyalty. So, for example, in the early Reform movement, all of the references to the return to Zion are eliminated from the prayer book. Hebrew is virtually eliminated from the early Reform prayer books and replaced with German. The early Reform rabbis wore the winged collars of the Protestant clergy and introduced an organ into the synagogue. Even amongst the neo-Orthodox, there were changes that reflected this. For example, Samson Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, was the founder of neo-Orthodoxy in Germany, studies at the University of Bonn, something that was unheard of for an Orthodox rabbi. He translates the prayer book, the book of Psalms, the five books of Moses, the Torah, into German, and he gives his sermon in German. Those were radical innovations at the time within the Orthodox movement, and they reflect a desire to become part of German society. As I mentioned a couple of days ago, when the Reform Synagogue was dedicated in Stuttgart, the rabbi proudly proclaimed, "Stuttgart is our Jerusalem." And that's why, for example, in the Reform movement, they don't observe 2 days of the pilgrimage festival holidays, right? They observe only 1 day of the first day of Passover and the last day of Passover, as we do in Israel, because if Stuttgart is our Jerusalem, then the synagogue we're going to is actually our temple, which is why the Reform movement calls the temple a temple. Of course, the Reform movement today is very different than it was then. Needless to say, and the last Reform Siddur that was produced actually had more Hebrew than any other Reform Siddur ever produced in the history of the movement, more ritual. So, you know, what I'm talking about is classical Reform, but it was true of Neo-Orthodoxy too. There was a movement to acculturate. There was a movement to gain acceptance. There was a movement, as Samson Raphael Hirsch called it, Yafet Talmud Torah in Derech Eretz. It is beautiful to have the study of Torah together with Derech Eretz, and Derech Eretz can be interpreted in many ways. Some interpret it as Derech Eretz, manners, politeness. Others interpret it as getting a job, working. He interpreted Derech Eretz as the way of the land, the language of the land, the culture of the land, the literature of the land. If you can put those two together, said Samson Raphael Hirsch, that's the ideal. So, and Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer in Berlin follows us in footsteps and perhaps goes even a little bit further. So across those new denominations, the modern denominations, we see a Jewish reaction along a spectrum. But nonetheless, what they have in common is they are all trying to figure out, how can I be a Jew and a German at the same time? Before the emancipation, it was easy. There was no question. I was a Jew. Of course I wasn't a German. I wasn't a citizen of Germany. I wasn't considered an equal in Germany. I had no desire, usually, to be an equal in Germany, or England, or France, or Russia, wherever it was. But after the emancipation, most Jews want both. They want to embrace modernity, and they want to embrace the country in which they live, and they want to be embraced by the country in which they live.
What year are we in now, David?
We're talking about the 19th century. That's what we're talking about. The denominations are early and mid-19th century, and all of this is going on till the late 19th and early 20th century, when people are still talking about the Jewish question. How do we negotiate this? The Heinrich Heines, they found one solution. They abandoned Judaism. They said, I can't be both Jewish and German at the same time and have the life I want, and therefore, to heck with the Jewish stuff. And that was one response. But for most Jews, there was a desire to somehow hold on to their Jewishness and yet be modern Germans or modern Englishmen. Okay? That's actually how we got to where we are today. If you look at the Jewish world today, in many ways, that's how we got there. Of course, today, there's much greater acceptance of the idea that you can be this, you can be that, etc. We don't talk about the Jewish question anymore in the same kind of way. But we are products of this struggle. And what we're going to be doing now, after this long introduction, is we're actually going to look at two of the early Zionist thinkers. And how? What did they identify as the biggest problem facing the Jewish people? And they have different questions. And then, of course, they will come up with different solutions. And these are two of the most important Zionist writers and thinkers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And as we'll see at the end of the class, their writings, their thought, their thinking still reverberates in Israel today. And they each had a very big influence. The first one we're going to look at is Theodore Herzl. Right? So just for those who may have forgotten what Theodore Herzl looks like, I figured I had to do it for Achad HaAm, but one day doing it for Achad HaAm, I have to do it for Theodore Herzl. So, what do you know about Theodore Herzl? What do you know about his early life? Yeah.
Austrian journalist.
Wait, where is he born?
Vienna.
No. Born
in? Hungary.
You're born in Budapest? Okay. You're right. Austro-Hungarian Empire is one. Yes. And later he will be living in Vienna. Okay, go ahead.
Journalist. Goes to cover the Dreyfus trial.
Let's not get to the Dreyfus trial yet. Anything else about his early life?
I think journalism was his second career to sustain himself. He was really a dramatist. He wanted to
a
be
playwright.
Famous as a play.
Yes,
a
some of his plays were put on the stage in Vienna.
And in New York as well.
Okay, yes.
I don't think he was considered himself that Jewish.
Right. He considered himself an atheist. He considered himself an atheist. In fact, he doesn't circumcise his only son. He has one son, Hans, He doesn't have them circumcised, which was quite unusual for Jews at that time.
Yeah. I think that his family was fairly well assimilated, although did retain, that is, his parents did retain some traditional feelings and practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that
good? Yeah. Yeah. They were quite acculturated, but there was a Jewish identity in the home. Herzl lives a very short life. He dies in his 40s. And his life as a Zionist is actually only 9 years, which is quite remarkable. He's one of these people who lived his life on fast forward. And at the age of 10, he wrote in his diary that he was going to build the Suez Canal. Tells us something about the person, that, you know, there was talk about the Suez Canal at this time, and the Panama Canal later on, and he had this dream of greatness. He had a dream of greatness even as a child. He didn't actually have a bar mitzvah at the age of 13, he had some kind of confirmation ceremony. His family moved to Vienna when he was 18 years old. Vienna was one of the great cultural capitals of Europe in the 19th century, a very cosmopolitan city. He goes to law school. While he's in university, he joins a fraternity, and the fraternity took part in a memorial for the composer Wagner. And it turned into, Wagner had certain anti-Semitic views. That's one of the reasons why the Nazis loved Wagnerian music. And Herzl, when he saw that the demonstration was turning anti-Semitic, left the fraternity, which tells us something about his Jewish identity at the time, that he had a sense of his Jewishness. He works as a civil servant for 1 year using his law degree, but that wasn't his passion. He wrote more than 20 plays, many more essays. And in 1892, he becomes a correspondent for the New Free Press, which was one of the leading Vienna dailies. And he becomes the Paris correspondent. If I had to give you an analogy of what it means like being the Paris correspondent for the New York Times. It was a very prestigious position. And his role there was less as a reporter, as we know it today, and more as an essayist. They called it a feuilletoniste. He wrote the kind of articles you read in the Sunday New York Times magazine. Right? Not the daily kinds of articles, but more essays. That's what his writing was about. Coming to France in the 1890s, there's one thing, coming to France in the 1890s, he actually encounters a good deal of anti-Semitism. Now, anti-Semitism was not new to him. He had been living in Vienna. And Vienna, at this time period, actually had a very openly anti-Semitic mayor, whose name was Karl Luger. And Karl Luger was elected mayor time and again. He was re-elected a few times on an anti-Semitic platform. Vienna was a third Jewish. That's more Jewish than New York was at the height of Jewish population in New York. It was 28%. And you know what the anti-Semites call New York? Jew York. That's how Jewish New York is, and especially was before the flight to the suburbs in the 1950s and 60s. It was 28%. In Vienna, the Jews were a third of the population. And there was a great deal of anti-Semitism there. Later, Adolf Hitler will also develop his anti-Semitism in Vienna. Karl Luger is an openly anti-Semitic mayor. He fires the Jews working for the municipality. He segregates the schools. His platform is openly anti-Semitic. So it's not as if he discovers anti-Semitism when he comes to France. He's encountered it in his hometown, in Vienna. But he comes to France at a time, let's call it, of peak anti-Semitism. One of the leaders of French anti-Semitism was Edouard Drumont. Edouard Drumont wrote a book called La France Juive. La France Juive was a bestseller, right? Jewish France, meaning the Jewish domination of France. It was a bestseller. It actually went through 100 printings in 1 year. In 1894, Captain Alfred Dreyfus is arrested for treason, for espionage. Dreyfus was a Jew. And the next decade include three long trials. And what's called in France, not the Dreyfus trials, the Dreyfus affair, lasts for a decade, dominates French politics and French society for a decade. I mentioned a couple of days ago when I mentioned Dreyfus, if you look at any book on the history of the French Third Republic, there'll be an entire chapter on the Dreyfus affair. So this is a major event in French history. Herzl is there in Paris. And the most important thing in Jewish history about the Dreyfus affair is not that a Jew was, it seems, falsely accused of espionage. The most important thing is that the reaction of the populace to this accusation were demonstrations in the streets, mass demonstrations saying, Abat les Juifs, à mort les Juifs, down with the Jews, death to the Jews. This was a full century after the French had emancipated the Jews. This was the most liberal country in all of Europe at the time. The Third Republic in France in the 1890s was the most liberal country in all of Europe. And if 100 years after Jews were granted equality, the mobs in the streets are crying, death to the Jews, down with the Jews, not down with Dreyfus. Then, says Theodor Herzl, emancipation has no future. It has failed. Now, Herzl was not the first to start writing about the possibility of Jewish sovereignty and Jewish self-rule. But he actually was unaware of his predecessors who had been writing before him. Moses Hess, Rabbi Alkali, Rabbi Kalischer, and Leon Pinsker in Russia. But Herzl, again, a man who thinks he's destined for greatness, decides to do something about it. And so, as someone who is a well-known journalist and a playwright, he gets an appointment to meet with Baron de Hirsch. Baron de Hirsch was a very, very well-to-do Jew who was supporting Jewish emigration, particularly from Russia, particularly to Argentina. He was the philanthropist who founded the ICA, the Jewish Colonization Association. And so he goes to Baron de Hirsch with his idea that the only solution to anti-Semitism is for the Jews to have their own country, to have political sovereignty. Herzl is the founder, not of Zionism. Zionism existed before him. Even modern Zionism existed before him. The first Aliyah begins in 1881, 1882. We're talking 1895. Rishon LeZion and Petah Tikva have already been established. But Herzl was the founder of political Zionism. What is the problem? Anti-Semitism. That's the biggest problem facing the Jews, says Herzl. What's the solution? A country of our own, where we will be the majority, where we won't be a minority. He goes to Baron de Hirsch because, first of all, he's an elitist, Herzl. He believes in working with the wealthy. Part of political Zionism was also working with, diplomatically, with the Pope. He's going to meet with the Pope. He's going to meet with the Sultan of Turkey. He's going to meet with the Kaiser of Germany. He's going to meet with Tsarist officials. And he thinks the wealthy people have influence and they'll be able to move things. Baron de Hirsch basically throws him out on his tail. Doesn't want to hear about it. So he decides to write a 65-page pamphlet which he calls Address to the Rothschilds. And Baron Edmund de Rothschild at this time was supporting the small Jewish settlements in the land of Israel. Right? You know the story of Carmel Wine, Zichron Yaakov and Rishon LeZion. Were fledgling communities. He sends his agents over there. He sends vines from France. He teaches them how, the agents teach the Jews how to make wine. And that's how the Carmel Wine Company actually begins, right? Through the beneficence of Baron Edmund de Rothschild. He supports the settlers in the land of Israel. By the way, he's buried outside of Zichron Yaakov. It's a very, very beautiful place to visit, where Baron Edmund de Rothschild is buried. And so, yeah, Ed?
Was Rothschild in Paris?
Yes, he was in Paris at the time. And Herzl expects, certainly, Edmund de Rothschild is going to understand what I'm writing. Rothschild doesn't want to hear from him. How do we explain that? How do we explain that somebody who's supporting the first Aliyah in such a generous way would not be willing to give a dime to Theodor Herzl?
Rothschild's a Frenchman.
Rothschild's a Frenchman, go ahead.
And his worldview, despite his philanthropy, was... excluded the idea of political sovereignty for the Jewish people.
Okay, good.
And he was afraid it would question his Frenchness, and the same thing happened in England with the rich Jews, the Montagues, etc., etc.
Absolutely. The one opponent of the Balfour Declaration in the British cabinet was Lord Montagu, who was Jewish. It was one thing for Lord Rothschild to help poor Jews who were settling in the land of Israel. That's philanthropy. That's stucca. But to align himself with a political movement that implied that the place for Jews was not in France, that implied that the Jewish homeland was somewhere else, that Baron Edmund de Rothschild was not willing to countenance. And by the way, eventually he will be won over, but not in the early stages. And he is known as Hanadiv Hayadua. In Zionist history, he becomes known as the generous philanthropist, the generous supporter. But at this time, he's not willing to hear it. In fact, Herzl's closest friends think that a screw has gone loose. They tell him that he ought to get professional help for his idea. Because the idea of a Jewish state at that time was ludicrous. Now, it's very hard for us. This is the challenge of studying history. The challenge of studying history is putting ourselves in the shoes of the people at the time. Because with 20/20 hindsight, we're all brilliant. Right? But if we want to understand history, we have to understand what were the people thinking and feeling at the time. At that time, the idea of the Jewish state was ludicrous. It's as ludicrous as if I told you that I'm going to create a basketball team in the NBA only of Jews. White Jews. Who can't jump. That's the reaction. That's the reaction people had. The Jews are going to have a state. What are you, crazy? It's like imagining the Jews having a military. Laughable. Laughable. Right? I don't know how many of you remember Jackie Mason's routine about the Israeli army. He says, you know, I don't understand, he says. I walk down the street, and, you know, you see two Jews walking down the street, and there are three young black men approaching them, and what do? They cross to the other side of the street. He said, Jews? Jewish soldiers? Impossible. So I went to Israel, and I decided I would try to figure out, how is it that the Jews are soldiers, such brave soldiers? And I met with some of the soldiers, and I want to tell you something, he said. They're not Jews, they're Puerto Ricans. They look like Puerto Ricans, they dress like Puerto Ricans. They're not Jews. I mean, you know, the idea was ludicrous. The idea was ludicrous. So now, let's go to the sources. Okay, and I want to give you some time. How are we doing time-wise? Okay. I want to give you some time to read on page 1, Theodor Herzl, 1860-1904. This is an article in the London Jewish Chronicle from 1896. It's more or less a quick summary of Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. The address to the Rothschilds, that 65-page pamphlet, becomes Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, which is his most famous work. We'll talk about another one later. And this is kind of a small summary of it, published in the London Jewish Chronicle. So why don't you read pages 1 to 5 and take, let's say, 10 minutes to finish that. So, what do you think? What are your reactions? What are your questions? What surprised you? What interested you? Yes.
The thing that surprised me the most was out of the blue when he said we're going to rebuild the temple.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's look at that. That's page 3.
I said it shocked me when I read he thought we would rebuild the temple. That was like out of the blue.
Right. Let's look at that paragraph, okay? Because here he's envisioning what it's going to be like. Our clergy, the bottom paragraph in the left-hand column.
What page is that?
Page 3 or 424.
Okay.
Our clergy, and who I have most especially called, devote their energies to the service of this idea. By the way, most did not. Right? But this is his plan. They must, however, clearly understand from the outset that we do not need to found a theocracy, but a tolerant modern civil state. We shall, however, rebuild the temple in glorious remembrance of the faith of our fathers. Meaning, what's the temple?
It's like a monument.
Like a monument. It's like a museum. In other words, it's a glorious memory, right, of the faith of our fathers. Not our faith. We're far beyond that. But we'll rebuild it, and, you know, we'll take tour groups through it. And, you know, it's true that he wants to rebuild the temple, but not in the way that some other people want to rebuild the temple. Okay? By the way, he was opposed by most of the Orthodox. He was opposed by the vast majority of the Reform. for different reasons. Yeah. Oh, okay. Who else? Yes.
Well, once the state is set up or the society, it seems to be more concerned about the Christians and the Europeans, and a little bit about the Sultan, although we'll be the treasury. We'll manage the finances, essentially, of the Sultan.
Right.
And no mention of Islam or Muslims, or maybe not any concept of it at all.
Right. Later on, and he writes another book called Altneuland, right? Old New Land. And by the way, its translation into Hebrew was titled Tel Aviv, which is where Tel Aviv gets its name from. From this utopian novel that Herzl writes about his dream of what the future Jewish state will look like. And so when Tel Aviv was founded in 1907, I think it was, 1909, maybe it was 1909, so they took the name of his book as being kind of the embodiment of what we envision. So when he writes Altneuland, he does talk about the Arabs, and within that, he portrays them as being very grateful for the economic advancement that the Jewish state has created for them. But they are a minority, not the majority. But yes, his concern is Eurocentric. Absolutely. That's where he lives. That's who thinks is going to be, you know, the main players here. And the Sultan, remember from your high school history class, the Ottoman Empire was the sick man of Europe, right? It was bankrupt. It was very, very much behind technologically. And so there were various plans. Herzl wasn't the first. There were other Zionist writers before him who talked about how we'll help the treasury of the Sultan in exchange for the land, we'll manage their finances, etc. Yes, Bob.
This is not a new idea. This fits in with the tradition. It's also not a particularly Jewish, a universal idea for freedom. So wants to be clear that this is not a revolutionary, it's an evolutionary idea.
Right, right. And you know, that's actually part of the power of Herzl's idea and of modern Zionism in general, is that it's an old idea in a new form. Right? That has a certain power to it. If it's totally new, so people, you know, okay, they react positively, negatively. When you have something that can touch something deeply, that's old, that's within people very much, and at the same time stated in a modern way, that has a certain power, and that's what he's trying to do here. And yes, not only Jewishly, but also universally, saying, you know, we're talking about self-determination for nations. Yes, Mike.
There were two passages that resonated so much to me today that they jumped right off the page. Near the end, he says, only desperados make their...
What page?
On first column, second paragraph. The poorest Jews only will go there, but it's precisely the poorest whom we need. Only desperados make good conquerors. The rich and well-to-do will follow later when they will find the new country as pleasant as the old. I guess we're still waiting for a lot of them. But that really resonated.
Yes. And you think that his prediction was true in the sense that the poorest were the ones who came first?
Well, I mean, it's not just the poorest, but the oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then at the beginning, the very beginning, it's the fourth sentence, the bad and foolish way we ridicule one another is a survival of slavish habits contracted by us during centuries of oppression. I don't know whether that's the reason or not, but we're still ridiculing one another every day.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, I actually think the next sentence is also significant. The free man sees nothing to laugh at in himself and allows no one to laugh at him. Boy, I don't know. Jewish humor is like very strong. We really do like to laugh at ourselves very much. Yes?
On page 4, he gives equal weight to territorialism. On page 4, he gives equal weight to territorialism as well as Zionism. He proposes either one would work and says that people should decide Argentina or Palestine.
Right. He says, page 4, the first full paragraph in the left column, shall we choose the Argentine Republic or Palestine? Right? Because I mentioned to you that Baron d'Arche had been promoting the settlement of Jews in Argentina. And he writes, you know, Argentina is a very fertile country, a vast area, they would profit. Palestine, on the other hand, is our ever-memorable historic home. The very name of Palestine would attract our people and a force of extraordinary potency. In other words, for him, this is a choice. It could be this, it could be that, and Palestine has as its main selling point the fact that it would be a marvelous rallying cry for our people. In other words, it's very instrumental. This later leads him into a little bit of trouble. The Sixth Zionist Congress takes place in 1903 after the Kishinev pogrom in Russia. The Kishinev pogrom was a terrible pogrom, lasted 3 days. Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote a famous poem about it called The City of Slaughter. It rocked the Jewish world. It was front page headlines in all the major newspapers in the world. I think the American Jewish Committee was founded as a result of the Kishinev pogrom.
When was it?
1903. And a British official, in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom, he had met with British officials before, and so they contact him and they say, listen, we've got some land in Africa. If you're serious, maybe we'll give you some of this land in Africa. It was called then Uganda. Today it's actually within the boundaries of the modern state of Kenya. And Herzl says, okay, he brings it to the Sixth Zionist Congress in 1903. And he says, and he sees there's some opposition, particularly from the Russian delegates. Very interesting. The Kishinev pogrom took place in Tsarist Russia. It's the Russian Jewish delegates who don't want to hear about Uganda. And so he says, you know what? It'll be a resting place for the night. It won't even be our permanent home, but just as a refuge for Russian Jews to escape to. The Russian Jews walk out. They were the largest delegation at the Sixth Zionist Congress. They walk out. The vote takes place. Herzl wins the vote, but he loses the war. And he never goes forward with the proposal. And he dies a year later in 1904. So this was really a fork in the road for the Zionist movement. Because as Seth said, there were territorialists like Herzl who were willing to consider other places other than Palestine that had greater advantages. They were more fertile. But the Zionist movement moves very, very quickly away from territorialism, and the Sixth Zionist Congress in 1903 is really that breaking point. From that point on, there's no serious discussion of other places within the Zionist movement. There are still some territorialists, but they become, well, as Lenin said about the Mensheviks, they go into the garbage can of history. They really don't develop anything beyond that. Yes? Yes.
What would it sound like today, like Babel? It would be, and also he does say, never cease to cherish the memory of the native land from which they had been driven.
Right, right. You know, he did think, and Al Neuland, he writes a little bit differently, and there he writes that Hebrew is the predominant language, but there's still many, many other languages that are being spoken. And I think he meant this as a way kind of to reassure people. Actually, it's one of the barriers of Aliyah for many people today, the language. Even though if you live in South Jerusalem, I'll share with you that English works just fine. But certainly language might be a barrier, and he's trying to lower the barriers. But it does reflect what he wanted. That is, he wanted a very cosmopolitan European society. That's what he portrays in Alt Neuland. The names that people give their children are European names. They're not giving them Hebrew names. By the way, Herzl himself never really learns Hebrew. Okay? Yeah?
Did he have any conception that there were Jews in the Arab
a great question.
Can you repeat
the question?
Did he have any sense that there were Jews living in Arab lands? I don't see evidence of it here or in the larger Jewish state. And I don't think I saw evidence of it in Alt-Neuland. Let's remember that Ashkenazim were 90% of the Jewish population of the world in 1939. Until the Shoah, Ashkenazim were 90% of the Jewish population of the world. Today, that proportion is radically different. About 50% of the Jews living in the land of Israel are not Ashkenazim, but Sfaradim, or Mizrahim. I'm not aware. I can't answer it fully, but I haven't come across it. It's a good question. I will mention that in 1881, there's an aliyah of Yemenite Jews who are not coming as part of the first aliyah, but are coming as part of a long tradition of aliyot that Jews made, both from Muslim countries as well as from European countries over the centuries, just like the students of the Vilna Gaon who came to the land of Israel. And Yehuda Levi in the medieval period who comes to the land of Israel. So those kinds of aliyot were taking place, and in Palestine at the time, when he's writing, probably about 50% of the Jews living here are Sephardim. Yes?
Herzl, as I read this very clearly, is interested in sovereignty.
Yes, that is his main point.
Change from religion, if you will, to national people.
Yes.
I was wondering, when did this, this is a real change, I think, in the way that Jews would see themselves,
yes.
And I think it's still an issue. I'm wondering, was this a nascent idea in the 1800s? I'm not sure when this developed and when the idea of Zion as opposed to Uganda and Argentina really took off.
Right. Andrew, did you want to answer that?
I would reframe the question a little bit. I would say the question is, when did Judaism be conceived as simply a religion and lose its political status, which it held for a long time prior?
Yeah. Right. You know, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, you'll see that the Jewish people are referred to as a people. They're not referred to as a religion. There's only one place where the Jews are referred to as a religion in the entire Hebrew Bible. It's in the last book of the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible. It's in the scroll of Esther, where Haman calls the Jews a dat, that tahem shonot, that their religious beliefs are different. Otherwise, look at the Hebrew Bible. We're called an am, a nation. We're called Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel. That's what we're called. So within Judaism, there's always been this national and religious component. And so as Jews reach modernity, Jews will be faced with the question of, what are we? It's part of the Jewish question. Are we a nation? Are we a religion? Are we both? The Reform movement, the classic Reform movement, said, we're Germans of the Mosaic faith. Get rid of that peoplehood idea. Get rid of that national idea. They're Germans of the Catholic faith, Germans of the Protestant faith. We're Germans of the Mosaic faith. They didn't even want to use the term Jew. Germans of the Mosaic faith. In other words, we're Germans. That's our national identity. And we also believe in a particular religion, just like Catholics and Protestants. So, I think that there are others who try to do it differently. So I think Herzl is part of that, and the modern Zionist movement, the secular modern Zionist movement, tends to view itself as being post-religious and maintaining the national element of Judaism. After all, a modern in late 19th century Europe understood that religion was something of the past, like the temple. It was a glorious monument to the faith of our forefathers, but we're beyond that. We're moderns. We don't believe in that superstition anymore. Yeah?
The way I read this is he takes on anti-Semitism as actually being
Uh-huh.
And that as a result, Christians will help us because we will leave places then for Christians to come in and take over where we are so that everyone will be happy in the end.
Right.
I think that's really unusual to turn what we're all fearing, anti-Semitism, into a positive.
Right. So anti-Semitism for him is the driving force. It's the question. It's the problem, right? And yes, he thinks that governments will actually be happy to get rid of anti-Semitism because anti-Semitism is destabilizing, right? No government wants to have riots in the streets. And so therefore, you know, the Jews will be replaced in a gradual way, he says. But the answer to anti-Semitism is sovereignty, right? If we are the majority and we have political control over a piece of land, then anti-Semitism will be eliminated. That was his formula. Linda, and then I want to move on.
Okay, I'm struck from the very beginning by the word scheme.
Yes.
I think it's, and it runs throughout. He doesn't call it a plan.
If you ask the British people in our audience, they'll tell you that it has a different ring to it.
Oh, okay.
A scheme is a plan. In American English, a scheme is cunning. A scheme is underhanded.
Right. That's
he wouldn't write that about himself.
Okay.
Right?
You're right.
Right? A scheme is a plan.
Was this written in English, or did he have it translated?
It's a very good question. Shira had asked me that as well. He generally wrote in German. I'm sure he was fluent in French. He was not in Hebrew. I don't know how good his English is. It's very possible it was translated by somebody else. Der Judenstaat, of which this is a short summary, was written in German. Last, Alan.
The Society of Jews.
Yes.
It struck me that this could have been the impetus for the Russian protocols of the elders.
Of Zion. Okay.
Zion.
Okay.
Because this is mid-90s, and I think it's generally attributed that the Russian KGB, so to speak, came up with this in the very early 1900s.
Excellent.
And
it's
Jews from around the world, elites from around the world coming together and making a plan.
Okay, this is a great segue, because ultimately Herzl calls the first Zionist Congress, which meets in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. And there, the organization is that's created out of the First Zionist Congress is called the World Zionist Organization. In other words, it's no longer called the Society of Jews, it's called the World Zionist Organization. Okay? And Herzl says, at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. Just as he writes here, that we may not live to see it, but we're planting for our children. But he believes when he founded the World Zionist Organization, what he calls Society of Jews here, he actually had founded the infrastructure for what would become the Jewish state. Now, Tsarist police officials in Russia create a forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it's written a few years after the First Zionist Congress. And they claim that this forgery are the secret minutes of the First Zionist Congress. So there is a direct connection. They claim it's the secret minutes. That's what the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is probably the most important modern anti-Semitic work, probably more important than Mein Kampf. It's been translated, unfortunately, into dozens of languages. It's still a bestseller. Particularly in Arabic. There was a Egyptian TV series, I think about a decade ago, after the peace treaty with Israel, which was a series. It's a whole series of TV shows about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and let's say it wasn't our understanding of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Okay, so Herzl, yeah, Shira. Adarava. He felt he founded the Jewish state in Basel. And by the way, when he travels to the London East End,
which was, for the Americans, that's like the Lower East Side of New York, London East End. And when he traveled to Tsarist Russia, he was mocked by the masses of Jews who related to his dream very much. He took great solace in that. He understood he had touched a real nerve in his writings and in his speaking. And, you know, my parents, Alehem HaShalom, came from Galicia. They came from a city called Brody in Poland. And there was a shul in Brody from the 1600s. Today it's a churva. Today it's a ruin. I visited there not long ago. And my parents used to say with great pride that Herzl stopped off in our town and he spoke in the shul, in the Alte Shul in Brody. So he was mobbed by Jews, and this was not what he expected, because he was focusing on the rich. He was focusing on the Rothschilds. He was focusing on the Baron de Hirsches. Lo and behold, his greatest support came from the poorer Jews, from the common Jews, from the East European Jews, or Jews from the East End who had come from Eastern Europe. That's where his greatest support came from. Herzl dies in 1904 of a heart condition. In his will, he asks that there be no speeches or flowers at his funeral. Thousands attended his funeral. And he wrote in his will, "I wish to be buried in the vault beside my father, and to lie there until the Jewish people will take my remains to Palestine." And indeed, in 1949, shortly after the Jewish state was created, his remains were transferred here to Jerusalem, and he's buried on the mountain that bears his name, Har Herzl, which is where many official ceremonies take place. When he died, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, who was then the chief rabbi of Jaffa, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, when Herzl died, called him and made a special eulogy for him and called him Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef meaning a messianic figure, not the Messiah himself, but a messianic figure, a precursor of the messianic era. Okay, we finished with Herzl, and now we have a little bit of time to talk about, I think, someone who's lesser known, probably, and that is Acharaam Asher Tzvi Ginzburg. Asher Tzvi Ginzburg is a radically different figure. Here's a picture, I'm turning it around. A radically different figure than Herzl. Couldn't be more different in his birthplace, in his upbringing, and ultimately also in his analysis of the Jewish problem. He's born in 1856 in a shtetl in Eastern Europe, not Budapest, the big cultured city. A town called Skvira. If you've ever heard of Skvira Hasidim, if you've ever heard of New Square near Muncie, New York, that's where he was born. And he's born into a Hasidic family who had very close ties to the Sadagura Rebbe. His family belonged to the aristocracy of the Hasidic world. And he was, as a child, viewed as an Elui, as a child prodigy in Talmud. And he began to write Chidushim, he began to write novella in Talmud as a young boy. He married at the age of 17. His parents set up a marriage for him with a woman who also had great Hasidic yichus, who had great, what do we call yichus?
Lineage.
Yes, who had great Hasidic lineage. His parents forbade his tutors to teach him the Russian alphabet. He only learned the Russian alphabet by looking at the signs of the stores and figuring out what it must be. Eventually, he moves on to Jewish philosophy, and from there moves on as an adult to Enlightenment and secular works, Haskalah literature, German and Russian literature, and moves away from religious observance. But his background is totally different, 180 degrees from Theodor Herzl. He moved to Odessa. Odessa was the capital of the Haskalah, of the Enlightenment movement among the Jews. And in 1889, he wrote his first essay called Lo Zeh HaDerech, This Is Not the Way, in a Hebrew publication called Hameli. So he's a Hebrew writer, again, in contrast to Herzl. And in it, he reports on visiting the early Jewish settlements, the early modern Zionist settlements of the first Aliyah. And he comes back scathing criticism. Lo zeh haderech. Scathing, lo zeh haderech. This is not the way. Scathing criticism. And he writes, you know what? The land of Israel is not going to be able to absorb all of the Jewish people. And what's going on there is, okay, it's not a bad thing, but the most important thing to do will be to educate the Jewish people globally. That's the most important thing to do. To educate the Jewish people globally. That's what he writes in Moshe HaDerech. We'll come to it in a moment. It will become clearer later on. He becomes the editor of the Hebrew monthly Hashiloach, which was probably the most important, most influential Hebrew publication of its time.
Is that Odessa?
Yes. Later he'll move to London, he'll work for the Vysotsky tea firm. He got tired of being a professional Jew, and so he works for the Vysotsky tea firm. But while he's in London, by the way, he's going to work closely with Chaim Weizmann for the Balfour Declaration. So this is a different kind of Zion. As we'll see. He questioned the value of those small communities that were being established in the land of Israel. He believed it had to be done slowly and with great care. He was concerned about relations with the Arabs in the land of Israel, much more so than Herzl. And what I want to do is I want to read with you, because we don't have enough time, I think, to read on your own. Here, page 8, the middle of the page, The Jewish State and the Jewish Problem, 1897. And he's writing now in the wake of the first Zionist Congress. Remember, this is where the World Zionist Organization is established. This is where Herzl said, at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. And now, let's see Echad HaAm's reaction to the first Zionist Congress. Page 8. Who's going to read for us? Some months. John, why don't you start us?
Okay. Some months have passed since the Zionist Congress, and its echoes are still reverberating in daily life and in the press. All kinds of gatherings, small and large, local and regional, are taking place. Since the delegates returned home, they have been calling public meetings and repeatedly regaling us with tales of the wonders that were enacted before their very eyes.
Do you get the sense of irony here, of sarcasm? Go ahead.
The wretched, hungry public is listening, becoming ecstatic and hoping for salvation. It is inconceivable to them that they, the Jews of the West, can fail to succeed in what they propose. Heads grow hot and hearts fast, and many leaders who had for years until last August lived only from Palestinian settlement, and for whom a penny donation in aid of Jewish labor in Palestine or the Jaffa school was worth the world, have now lost their bearings and asked one another, what's the good of this all? The days of the Messiah are near at hand, and we busy ourselves with trifles. The time has come for great deeds, for great
Great men.
Great men of the West, have enlisted in the cause and marched before us. There has been a revolution in their world, and to emphasize it, they have given the cause itself a no longer love of Zion, but Zion. But Zionism.
Tzionut. Let's leave it right there. Let's leave it right there. Thank you. So, what is Lachada Am saying? First of all, this is a great primary source to understand the excitement and the power of the First Zionist Congress. Because here's somebody who's obviously not so enamored by what's happening, and yet he's reporting to us that people are, they're thinking messianically. Yes, sir.
Do you have any idea how long or how thorough his tour? He said he came to Palestine. Did he know much about it, or he had a quick look at it, or?
I don't know how long he was here. It was not a long time. Later, he'll come back and settle in a little later. Okay. Chibat Zion, lovers of Zion, right? Some of you may know that the street in Jerusalem and a shul in Jerusalem called Chovevei Tzion, the lovers of Zion. Who were they?
Maybe the Russians.
It was basically the people of the first Aliyah called themselves the Chibat Zion movement. There was, in fact, in Tel Aviv, there's a street. I just discovered this. I was in Tel Aviv recently. There's a street named for the Katowice Congress. Right? Ve'idat Katowice is the name of a street in Tel Aviv. It was in Katowice in Poland that the Chibat Zion had their first actual meeting. This was back in 1882, I believe. It was 1882. I might be wrong. It might be in the, but it's in the early 1880s. Chibat Zion was a group of small grassroots Zionist movements, including the Bilu, who begin in Eastern Europe in the 1880s. And they are the people who launched the first Aliyah before Herzl, a decade before Herzl becomes a Zionist. This is a decade, 12 years before the Dreyfus trial. 14 years before he writes his address to the Rothschilds, which becomes Der Judenstaat. There's already a movement, a grassroots movement, of Jews who want to move to the land of Israel and want to establish something there. Exactly what is not clear. Maybe a Jewish state, maybe to revive the Hebrew language, but they want to establish something there. And they're the ones who are founding the early settlements of Petach Tikva and Zichron Yaakov and Rishon LeZion. And they're coming to Jerusalem too. That first Aliyah is from this Chibat Zion movement, the Chovevei Zion, the Lovers of Zion movement. And they get together in Katowice, in Poland, in the 1880s, and they begin to form a kind of a national organization. But it was from the bottom up, as opposed to the World Zionist Congress, which was from the top down. Okay? They're very, very different. And there's tension between them. You know, Herzl himself is not so happy with the settlements in Palestine. He calls them a tea kettle phenomenon. And what we really need, he says, is not a tea kettle. What we need is a steam engine. Achad Ha'am is a different point of view. Achad Ha'am identifies very much with the Chibat Zion movement. The Chibat Zion movement, which, by the way, was supported and for a time led by the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, who was a passionate Zionist, and later led by Leon Pinsker, Dr. Leon Pinsker, who wrote Auto-Emancipation, which I mentioned a couple of days ago, Auto-Emancipation, meaning self-emancipation. Forget about being emancipated by others. The only way for us to actually be free is to emancipate ourselves. If somebody emancipates you, it means they also have the power to take it away, to remove it. True emancipation only comes if it's done by ourselves. That's the Chibat Zion movement. And the Chibat Zion movement, as I said before, is... there were a lot of religious people. In fact, most historians believe that most of the members of the first Aliyah were religious. If you read the manifesto of the Bilu, you see that it's it's a very religious document. And they're the ones who begin the modern settlement of the land of Israel. And it's different. It's not the same as the old Yishuv, as the Jews who are already living here, who are living in the Holy Land. For them, the land was holy. But they were coming to do something different. They were coming to make a change. They were coming either to establish a Jewish state or to revive the Hebrew language or to do something that was actually quite modern.
But isn't it a direct result of the same forces? I mean, it's the pogroms of 1880, 1881.
Yes, and all of the centuries of traditional Zionism that we talked about? Absolutely. But you see, they're coming from different directions. They're coming from different directions. Let's look at the next paragraph, Nordau's address. Linda, will you read for us? Page 9.
Nordau's address on the general condition of the Jews was a sort of introduction to the business of the Congress. It described in incisive language the sore troubles, whether material or spiritual, which beset the Jews the world over. In Eastern countries, their trouble is material. They must struggle without let up to satisfy the most elementary physical needs, for the crust of bread and the breath of air, which are denied them because they are Jews. In the West, in lands where the Jews are legally emancipated, their material conditions is not particularly bad, but their spiritual state is serious. They want to take full advantage of their legal rights and cannot. They long to be accepted by the Gentile majority and to become part of the national society, but they are kept at arm's length. They hope for love and brotherhood, but they encounter looks of hatred and contempt from all sides. They know that they are in no way inferior to their neighbors ability or virtue, but they have it continually thrown in their faces that they are an inferior type and they are unfit to rise to the level of the Aryans and more to the scene of that.
Right.
Well, what then?
Right. So here you can see the term Aryan was used well before the Nazis used that term. Let's skip down. There is no doubt. The last paragraph. Who's willing to read for us? Please.
There's no doubt that even when the Jewish state is established, Jewish settlement will be able to advance only by small degrees, as permitted by the resources of the people themselves and by the progress of the economic development of the country. Meanwhile, the natural increase of Jewish population, both within Palestinian settlement and in the diaspora, will continue, with the inevitable result that, on the one hand, Palestine will have less and less room for new immigrants. On the other hand, despite continual emigration, the number of those remaining outside Palestine will not be appreciably diminished.
Let's stop there for a second. In other words, Herzl, your idea is not going to work. Because I, Echad HaAm, also believe in settling the land, but it can only be done by a small number. We can never imagine that the majority of Jews are actually going to be living in the land of Israel. Let's continue in his opening.
In his opening speech at Congress, Dr. Herzl, wishing to demonstrate the superiority of his state idea to the previous form of Palestinian colonization, calculated that by the latter method, it would take 900 years before all the Jews could be settled in their land. The members of the Congress applauded this as a conclusive argument, but it was a cheap victory. The Jewish state itself will do what it will find no way to make a more favorable calculation.
Right.
The truth is bitter, but with all its bitterness, it is better than illusion.
I love that sentence. Right. This is Echad HaAm. Echad HaAm is not the leader, not the organizer, not the visionary that Theodor Herzl was. He is, in certain ways, a naysayer. He's a critic. And this sentence, just like his first article called Lo Zeh HaDerech, this is not the way. And here he says, the truth is bitter. With all its bitterness, it is better than illusion. Keep going.
we must admit to ourselves that the ingathering of exiles is unattainable by natural means. We may, by natural means, someday establish a Jewish state. It's possible that the Jews may increase and multiply within it until the land is filled with them. But even then, the greater part of our people will remain scattered on foreign soils. To gather our scattered ones from the four corners of the earth, in the words of the prayer book, is impossible. Only religion, with its belief in miraculous redemption, can promise such a consummation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, you notice, by the way, he's peppering this with quotes, you know, from his education, very, very clearly.
He says only religion, but he has left religion.
He has left religion. In other words, he's saying, only if you're religious can you believe in the idea of kibbutz galuyot, that all the Jews will be gathered from all the four corners of the earth. Yes, we might one day have a Jewish state. And yes, we might have many Jews living here. But the majority of Jews, they're not going to come to Israel. They're not going to come to the Jewish state. So says Achad Ha'am, writing in 1897. So what is it that Achad Ha'am envisions? Because we're running out of time, and I don't want to run over. What is it that Achad Ha'am envisions? If I've said so far, he's a naysayer, he's a critic. What is he a Zionist? He is, but he's a different kind of Zionist. He's not a political Zionist like Theodore Herzl. He is what can be called either a spiritual Zionist, that's what he used to be called. Today I'd call him a cultural Zionist, because his spirituality was not really what we call spirituality today. He was a cultural Zionist. Why was he a cultural Zionist? Because Achad Ha'am looked at the Jewish world and didn't see the biggest problem facing the Jewish people as anti-Semitism. He believed, as the saying goes, "Avarnu et Paro, navor gam et zeh." We got through Pharaoh. We'll get through this too. Anti-Semitism, that's not new for the Jewish people. Yes, we'll suffer, but yes, ultimately we'll survive, he says. What's the biggest problem facing the Jewish people today? At the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s?
Assimilation
is our greatest threat. Because if you look at what's happening to our people, we're moving farther and farther away from our religious observance. He is obviously a case in point. How is the Jewish people going to survive? The only way it can survive, he believes, is if it can create a modern Hebrew culture. He's from the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Religion was in decline. It was very clear to them that in modernity there would be no more room for religion. The only way for the values of our religion and the values of our people to survive is in a modern, vibrant Hebrew culture. How can we create a modern, vibrant Hebrew culture in Europe? We can't, because we're too influenced by Russian culture, by French culture, by German culture. It's all around us. The only way to create a modern, vibrant Hebrew culture is in the land of Israel. There, we can create an authentic modern Hebrew culture. There, we can go back to our history, our ancient history. We can go back to our sources. He believed in a secular vision version of Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. From Zion shall come forth Torah, but in a secular version. He gives an analogy of a wheel. Every wheel has a middle, and then there are spokes leading to the larger perimeter of the wheel. And he believed that center would be the land of Israel, where there would be a vibrant Jewish community speaking in Hebrew, writing in Hebrew, with Hebrew newspapers, with Hebrew theater, with Hebrew literature, with universities that would develop all sorts of departments in Jewish history and Jewish thought. And they would feed the diaspora, like the spokes of a wheel, he says. So that center is very necessary. We don't imagine that all of the Jews will live there. But from that center will come forth a vibrant culture that will ultimately feed and sustain the diaspora. That's his vision. And I want to turn now to page 14, where I think he is most biting in his critique of Herzl. Take a look at the beginning of the first paragraph, The Secret. Who's willing to read for us? Please, Bob.
The secret of our people's persistence is, as I've tried to show elsewhere, that at a very early period, the prophets taught us to respect only the power of the Spirit, not to worship material power. Therefore, unlike the other nations of antiquity, the Jewish people never reached the point of losing its self-respect in the face of more powerful enemies. As long as we remain faithful to this principle, our existence has a secure basis, and we shall not lose our self-respect, for we are not spiritually inferior to any nation. But a political ideal which is not grounded in our national culture is apt to seduce us from loyalty to our own inner spirit and to beget in us a tendency to find the path of glory in the attainment of material power and political domination. Political dominion. Thus breaking the thread that unites us with the past and undermining our historical foundation. Needless to say, if the political ideal is not attained, it will have disastrous consequences because we shall have lost the old basis without finding a new one. But even if it is attained under present conditions, when we are a scattered people, not only in the physical but also in the spiritual sense, even then Judaism will be in great danger. Almost all our great men, those that is, whose education and social position have prepared them to be the head of the Jewish state, are spiritually far removed from Judaism and have no true conception of its nature and its value.
He's talking about Herzl and some of the other leaders of the Zionist movement. Go ahead.
Such men, however, loyal to their state and devoted to its interests, will necessarily envisage those interests by the standards of the foreign culture which they themselves have imbibed, and they will endeavor by moral persuasion or even by force to implant that culture in the Jewish state, so that in the end the Jewish state will be a state of Germans or Frenchmen of the Jewish race. We have even now a small example of this process in Palestine.
Okay, we'd like to continue reading the next paragraph, history, please.
History teaches us that in the days of the Herodian house, Palestine was indeed a Jewish state, but the national culture was despised and persecuted. The ruling house did everything in its power to implant Roman culture in the country and frittered away the resources of the nation in the building of heathen temples, amphitheaters, and so forth. Such a Jewish state would spell death and utter degradation for our people. Such a state would never achieve sufficient political power to deserve respect, while it would be estranged from the living inner spiritual force of Judaism. The puny state, being tossed about like a ball between its powerful neighbors and maintaining its existence only by diplomatic shifts and continued truckling to the favor of the fortune, would not be able to give us a feeling of national glory. The national culture in which we might have sought and found our glory would not have been implanted in our state and would not be the principle of its life. So we should really be then, much more than we are now, a small and insignificant nation, enslaved in spirit to the favorite of fortune, turning an envious and covetous eye on the armed force of our powerful neighbor. Our existence in such terms as a sovereign state would not add a glorious chapter to our national history.
Right. So Ahara Am is saying, a state, in and of itself is not what we need. Because our problem, our major problem is not anti-Semitism. Our major problem that we face that could actually destroy the Jewish people is assimilation. And unless we can create a culture that is appealing to the next generation, that can rival the culture of European nations, unless we can do that, we're in very big trouble. And a state in and of itself is not the answer. I want to stress again that when he was with Chaim Weizmann in London, and working towards the Balfour Declaration, that was actually the greatest victory of political Zionism up to that point in 1917. And by the way, the centennial of it is coming this November 2nd. He was not against the Jewish state, but he felt the key was not the Jewish state. The key was to create that kind of culture. Yeah,
Bob. That's a question, because if it sounds, if I hear this right, and I don't know how other than what you're doing today, is he looking for a Jewish culture which is divorced from religion? And if that's so, how does he see it sustained?
He thought that it would have a power of its own. He thought it would have a life of its own. He, you know, although he's no longer personally observant, right, he would not have been opposed to people being religious. In other words, they would still be around. I would say if Achadam was living today and he saw that in all of the denominations, the rabbinical students all come to Israel to study, I think he would say, yes, that's the way it should be. He wouldn't say, who needs them? They're going to be rabbis. Okay? I don't think he saw it as divorced from religion. I think he saw it as the next step, or based on religion. I think he appreciated his own education, even though he was no longer observant. And I don't think that he would have insisted that everybody get a religious education in Israel. But, for example, he would have insisted that everybody know Tanakh very well. Everybody know the Hebrew Bible very well, and everybody know Jewish history very well. And that holidays would be observed perhaps in a more modern form. I think those things would have been important to him. Yes?
What would he say about the ultra-Orthodox in this country? Because he keeps referring to spiritual, spirituality.
Right. Right. Yes, yes. Again, I think again, sometimes, you know, he writes more than a century ago, and I think that when he's writing spiritual, I think he's talking about the spirit. Things of the spirit, meaning things more of culture as opposed to material. Okay? Yes.
Yeah. So he's basically looking for the Jewish rival to German and French culture based on the tradition of the writings of those cultures. Writings and thoughts and philosophies.
Yes, that's what he's talking about. We have to take our sources, our classical sources that are so rich, and we have to somehow bring them into the modern period. We have to create new Jewish music. We have to create new Jewish dance, new Hebrew literature. And he did see the Hebrew language as a key to all of that. So let's just take I'll finish with the Chara'am, and then we're going to take a look at how does Israel today reflect the vision of Herzl and the vision of Achara'am, and does it not reflect their visions? So let's finish up with Achara'am. Achara'am makes Aliyah after the Balfour Declaration around 1920. When he comes to Tel Aviv, the street that he moves to is named after him immediately during his lifetime. And the mayor of the city closes off the city during his afternoon nap hours. And as Arthur Hertzberg writes in The Zionist Idea, when he dies in 1927, all Tel Aviv attended his funeral. That's first of all a reflection of how big Tel Aviv was in 1927. But all of these things are also an indication of the tremendous respect that he had. Achara'am was a very influential figure. He was never the head of the World Zionist Organization or of some big institution. But he had a tremendous impact on people like Chaim Weizmann, who's a political Zionist, but also believes in the cultural aspect. Chaim Weizmann liked to call himself a synthetic Zionist, not synthetic as in artificial, but as in synthesis, of trying to bring together the ideas of both Herzl and the Achara'am. So he dies in 1927.
But how did he occupy himself when he was in Israel?
He kept writing.
Writing
and teaching.
He didn't need anything.
He didn't lead any. He wasn't an organization person. He wasn't an institution person. He was a writer. He was a thinker. He was a critic.
And he was promoting education of Jewish sources.
Yes.
He was.
Yes. But again, but creating a modern Hebrew culture that was based on our classical sources. Okay. So, so how do we see Herzl and Achara Am? How do we not see them in Israel today? Give me examples. Yes.
The
Hebrew University is a great example of something that Achara Am would have, he was actually alive when it was created, would have said, yes, this is what we need. You know, I don't know how many of you realize it, but if you look at the Jewish history departments in various universities, the Jewish studies departments, they're called, in various universities around the world, almost all of them have a few courses in Jewish history. Okay? If you go to the Hebrew University, or you go to Bar Ilan or Tel Aviv University, if you look at the Jewish history department, they have as many Jewish history courses on the medieval period as any university outside of Israel has on all of Jewish history. Forget about the courses they have on the ancient period. Forget about all the courses they have on the modern period. Just take the medieval period. It's just so much deeper. I mean, there's a reason why Jewish studies professors almost always come to Israel on sabbatical. This is where the resources are. The National Library of Israel would be another example of this. Okay? What else? Yes?
Well, the diaspora. Israel's a source of pride or inspiration, business, technology, the army, it's the hub, it's the wheel that drives it, the hub that drives the big wheel, or spirit.
You think it is?
Yeah, in many cases.
Okay.
And in some phenomenons and aspects over some decades.
Right. Look, I would say that Birthright and all of the teen tours to Israel, and as I mentioned before, the rabbinical students who come to Israel. If you look, there was a study done recently about Jewish leaders in the United States. And among young Jewish leaders, almost all of them have spent a significant amount of time in Israel. And I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but so many of the tunes and songs, Jewish songs, whether synagogue melodies or Jewish songs in general, so many of them come from Israel, not to mention the Hebrew literature. I think the fact that David Grossman just won the Man Booker Prize, one of the most prestigious prizes for a writer, would be something that Achara Am would be quelling about. Yes?
I think Pardes is a perfect,
I think you'd do a better job than me.
No, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
What I'm saying is we're here, as North American Jews here, and we're going back. I'm not staying here, but the culture, everything is what we would love to see.
Excellent. There. Excellent. You know, everybody has been commenting about the Pardes faculty, which is truly a remarkable faculty. But I want to tell you it's part of a larger phenomenon. We have in Jerusalem, in Gush Etzion, in Beit Shemesh, we have a crazy concentration of fantastic Jewish studies teachers. Crazy concentration. More than any place else in the world. Yes?
I just wanted to say that some of those elements that you mentioned, there is a political element in the songs, in the literature, in the army, and the programs of people who come to Israel. They are not lacking in political context.
Yeah. There's no doubt that Herzl's greatest vindication was the creation of a Jewish state. That was his dream. It may not be, or maybe it is, as cosmopolitan, as European as he envisioned. It may not be the model state that he envisioned. You know, I don't know if you got to it in the reading. He had a white flag with seven stars. In Herzliya, named for Herzl, in Herzliya, there's actually a street called the Seven Star Street. right? So he imagined that we would be a kind of model for the world. I don't know whether we've actually attained that yet, although maybe in certain ways, you know, in water conservation and in water recycling, you know, and maybe some, maybe high tech, maybe there are certain ways, and security and defense things, unfortunately, we've become world leaders. But he envisioned us becoming world leaders in other ways that we haven't yet become. I see that Della is already shuffling her papers, and it's already 11 o'clock. So I just want to conclude. We can look at Israeli society and see evidence of where Herzl would turn over in his grave, the theocracy, the power of the rabbinate in Israel today. We can see ways in which Ahad Ha'am would turn over in his grave. How much English is being spoken in Jerusalem? How many signs, store signs, you know, you see in English? There are many things that reflect their values and don't reflect their values. But there's no doubt that these two were together perhaps the two most important influences, the political Zionism and the cultural Zionism on this country. I find it fascinating that Herzl, who was living in Western Europe, who's a very acculturated Jew, saw the biggest problem as anti-Semitism, when anti-Semitism was actually worst in the East, where Ahad Ha'am lived, in Russia. And Ahad Ha'am, who's living in the middle of the worst pogroms, sees the biggest problem not as anti-Semitism, but in assimilation, which is much more advanced than the West. It's very interesting that each one of them sees sort of the biggest problem outside of themselves in a way, right? And the other guy.
But Herzl was right, the next 30, 40 years.
Herzl was right, certainly, in terms of, we look back on European history, and we see the Shoah, and two-thirds of European Jewry was murdered by the Nazis. Certainly, Herzl was right about that. And I think we can say Ahad Ha'am was right as well about the dangers of assimilation and the loss to the Jewish people. These are two people who reflect the wide spectrum of modern Zionism. And perhaps we can learn two things. First of all, not to expect one voice from the Zionist movement or from modern Israel, and to understand that these different voices are actually a machloket l'shem shamayim, an argument for the sake of heaven, and the very different viewpoints that we hear in the modern Zionist movement as well as in Israel today actually enrich us. Each one has something to contribute. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.